All right, welcome back, everybody. It is Wednesday, September 29th, 11:17. I'm logging in a slight bit late. I apologize. Today's Free Radical. We're looking at the Free Radical chapter today. So let's kind of jump in. I'm going to remind everybody that in lab today, this morning, we were doing a lot of problems sessions, solving sessions. And so if you're in the lecture only and not in the lab, you're going to want to watch the lab exercise from today and catch all that problem solving stuff, because those are some good problems that we went through. All right. The Free Radical chapter brings some new reactions for us. And in this chapter, some of this we've already discussed, so some of this is review, and then some of it is going to be quite new. It's not a big chapter, it's not a super big chapter, but there are some important reactions in it that are synthetically useful, and so there are a bunch of reactions that we're going to see that will fit into our toolbox and we will use quite frequently. All right, to start off with, when we look at free radicals, we always want to compare what we know with what we're learning. So when we've looked at reactions before or dissociations before, the main type of dissociation that we have looked at when we use heat is a heterolytic dissociation where we create ions, cation and anion. So this is heterolytic. Asymmetric is the way that I think about that. What we're going to be looking at now is a homolytic dissociation. This is where we cleave the bond, not next to one of the elements, but in the middle between the two elements. And this is also done thermolytically, and we create the radicals. And we describe this as homolytic. A symmetric type of cleaving. And really the difference, you know, we were discussing arrows the other day. The difference between the arrows is two electrons versus one electron. And we use what we call the fishhook arrow. For a single electron versus a full arrow. Or a double-ended arrow for the two electrons. And it's important that we use the right arrow, because mechanistically we're going to be watching that when we use an arrow that we're moving the electrons in the appropriate way. All right, structure. We've talked about free radical structure before. And when we start to look at free radical structure, there is the possibility that when we look at a free radical, that a free radical could have one of two possible sort of structures. We could look at a free radical as having an sp3 hybridization, or we could look at a free radical as having an sp2 hybridization. And the question is, which way is correct? When we look and observe at free radicals, what do free radicals look like? And the question is one of understanding the nature of a free radical, because we know that when we look at carbanions, that carbanions have the two electrons, the negative charge, and are sp3 hybridized. And when we look at carbocations, we know that carbocations are sp2 hybridized, trigonal planar. And so the question is, are they more carbanion-like or are they more carbocation-like? And the answer is that when we look at free radicals and we analyze their structure, that we find that the free radicals are sp2 hybridized in nature. that the single electron occupies an unhybridized p orbital. And that means that they are very similar to carbocations. And that's actually really nice to know, because once we know that they're very similar to carbocations, all of the same things that stabilize carbocations also stabilize free radicals. So free radicals are similar in structure to carbocations. And stabilized by many of the same factors. So that allows us to be able to take carbocation stability and link it to free radical stability. So we don't have to do a whole ton of new learning and new properties and principles. We just get to apply directly what we know about carbocations directly to free radicals. So when we look at carbocations, then we can take a lot of the same things that we already know, right? We could look at a methyl carbocation and a primary carbocation, a secondary carbocation, tertiary. And we know that stability factors, right, that they go towards the more stable as we go from methyl to primary to secondary to tertiary, that they get more stable because of the electron donating groups. That essentially what we have is we have more electron donating ability by each one of the methyl groups, and that the methyls or alkyls act as electron donating groups, feeding electron density towards the carbocation and thereby helping to stabilize the carbocation. So the more electron donating groups we have, the more stable it is. With free radicals, it's exactly the same. We can look at a methyl free radical, a primary free radical, secondary free radical, and of course the tertiary free radical. And the free radicals are more stable the more substituted the free radical becomes. So that is true as well. And it's true for the exact same reasons. It's true because free radicals are electron deficient. Similar to carbocations. And so they're stabilized by all the same factors. So not only do we look at electron donating groups as stabilizing, right? So we see that electron donating groups stabilize free radicals. Also, resonance. And we know that resonance is a bigger factor, right? So if we look at resonance always over induction, so resonance is a much bigger factor than induction. And it stands to reason that while resonance can stabilize carbocations better than induction, resonance can also stabilize free radicals better than induction. So that's the next idea that we look at, is we look at carbocation resonance and free radical resonance and how they how they match up. All right, so when we look at carbocation resonance, that resonance is drawn with a single arrow. And the positive charge moves accordingly so that we can draw that carbocation resonance. When we draw free radical resonance, it looks very similar, except what we're going to do is homolytically cleave the bond, and it requires more arrows to show the flow of the electrons. And yet it accomplishes the same goal. We move the free radical from position A to position B. So this is an allylic carbocation. This is an allylic radical. And the resonance associated with the allylic radical. And it requires three arrows versus the one arrow just for a single resonance structure. And so if we're moving multiple locations, right? So let's say that we've got a bunch of bonds and we want to move this in a free radical resonance way, then what we would need to do is it's going to take a whole lot more arrows to show the flow of those electrons from one side of the molecule to the other. And I'm skipping over some of the resonance contributors because I just want to show how many arrows it takes to be able to do this. But it takes a whole lot more arrows, and we need to be a little bit more careful about how we draw those arrows in order to show the flow of the electrons. Okay. And just like allylic radicals, or I should say just like allylic carbocations, we had some very stable carbocations. Those very stable carbocations were the allylic carbocation and the benzylic carbocation. Those have analogs in very stable free radicals. We can have the allylic free radical, and we can have a benzylic free radical. And that those analogs are all really stable. Let's look at some common patterns for free radical reactions. As we start to get into free radical reactions, the first thing to note is that there's no hydride or alkyl shifts. With free radicals. That means that there's no rearrangements. As we have with carbocations. And the reason really is because when we look at carbocations, the carbocation is so electron deficient And if we think about that hyperconjugation model, where the sigma bond is adding electron density to the carbocation, that hyperconjugation model led to this movement of the proton where it could undergo the hydride shift. And then this back donates. So color-wise, if we think about this, we could think about this as the sigma bond and one lobe of the empty p orbital. And that empty p orbital can very easily sort of slide over. And you can get the hydride shift with carbocations. But with free radicals, the free radical is simply not as electron deficient. And so while hyperconjugation takes a place, it doesn't take place as strongly as it does with the free radical or as with the carbocation. And so we could look at this, and this is just very weak. I would say it's a weak interaction. And so no shift observed. It's just not needed because the free radical is not as electron deficient. As the carbocation is. So these are just a lot stronger interactions. And this guy is just weak and not donating as much. All right. So that's why we don't see the rearrangements. But these other patterns that we do see when we start to look at these common types, there are repeated patterns that we see over and over again for each of the free radical reactions. They usually start with an initiation step. The initiation step is a homolytic cleavage. And that homolytic cleavage step looks like oftentimes it's two atoms in which light strikes the molecule with enough energy that will homolytically split the bond and deliver us two free radicals. And so we wind up with two free radicals there. Now, sometimes this is heat, sometimes it's heat and light that does that initiation step. Once we get the initiation step, then the next step is often addition to pi bond. Here, what happens is the pi bond and the halogen interact. They interact in such a way that the pi bond cleaves, sending one electron to join the free radical and the other electron to make a new free radical on the carbon. In these steps, we generate the free radical, and this would be the secondary free radical, which is more stable. Than the primary free radical. So it could be just as we had protonation, right? If I sort of remind you about protonation, when we took a double bond and this guy reached out and grabbed the proton, that the proton would always add to the terminal end, giving the more stable carbocation. The free radical reaction is doing the exact same thing. Notice the similarities between the two, right? That we've grabbed the X out on the terminal end, generating the more stable free radical. We grab the proton at the terminal end, generating the more stable carbocation. So the addition to pi bond runs exactly the same way for exactly the same reasons. Number three, we look at hydrogen abstraction. This is where the free radical acts as a base to pull a proton. So we can say we have HR and a free radical that is sitting here. The free radical will abstract the proton. And the way that we draw those is we take the arrows and we combine the arrows, usually one from the top, one from the bottom. It's okay to do them and bring them in together like this. So either way, I like to sort of swing them. Oops, that was a double arrow. I like to swing them from opposite sides in bringing them together. But there's no standard convention or no way that it absolutely has to be drawn. X then combines with the proton. And what we generate is we generate R radical. In addition to hydrogen abstraction, this is where radical as base we can see that free radical also pull other things besides protons, which is really interesting. So we can see halogen abstraction. So oftentimes a free radical, such as a free radical on a carbon, can abstract a halogen from another carbon. And it is identical to the hydrogen abstraction. And it happens for much the same reasons. Halogens have a lot of lone electrons on them, and they very easily undergo free radical reactions. The R groups, depending upon if it's on a secondary or tertiary, generate some very pretty stable free radicals. And so it's frequent that we can see a halogen abstracted from an organic molecule as well, undergoing a free radical reaction. And so we generate Rx, and R prime now becomes the free radical. Next step, we have elimination steps. In an elimination step, here what we have is oftentimes the carbon radical and a leaving group. Let's do it with LG rather than halogen. And here what happens is same idea. That leaving group can be a free radical or other leaving group, but the leaving group is going to go off as a free radical. So it needs whatever the leaving group is, it needs to be a stable free radical. And the other thing that we generate here is an alkene. So the elimination step is the opposite of the addition step. If we go back and we look at that addition step, addition to a pi bond. We have the free radical coming in, breaking the pi bond, going to the free radical here. In this case, what we have is the free radical causing the elimination of the leaving group. It's just the reverse step. And then sometimes we also have coupling steps. This is a termination step. In a termination coupling step like this, we typically have two free radicals which find each other. And in finding each other, come together and make a sigma bond.
That is kind of unlikely, is it?
It is unlikely, but it does happen. And so it is concentration controlled. The more concentration, the higher the concentration of free radicals, the more likely that you'll get coupling steps. When free radicals are in low concentration, then you get these chain reactions and polymerization steps. So all of these steps that we're seeing, if we go back to the beginning, notice what happens. Initiation generates two free radicals. Addition to a pi bond generates a free radical. Hydrogen abstraction generates a free radical. Halogen abstraction generates a free radical. Elimination generates a free radical. Termination is the only one that does not produce a free radical. It stops the chain reaction. So free radicals, free radical reactions are chain reactions because almost every step where a free radical reacts, it generates another free radical. And that's one of the things that makes free radical reactions harder to control and a very fascinating, interesting area of study. Rebecca Braslow up at UCSC studies free radical reactions. She teaches many of the undergraduate organic chemistry classes and other chemistry classes. And her free radical polymerization reactions and things that she studies are really, really cool. But she's involved in looking at all of these different cycles and how these reactions work and controlling these reactions to a great degree. So when you think about polymerizations of plastics, most of the polymerizations of plastics that we know of are free radicals. Most of the things where we're making polymers, there are two different main types of polymers. There's what's called condensation polymers, and then there's free radical polymers. All of your polyethylene, polypropylene, polystyrene, all of those poly type things tend to be free radical reactions that we're looking at, except polyamides. Polyamides are condensation polymers, or polyesters are condensation reactions. But most of the things that we make, plastic ropes, plastic containers, all of that stuff, that's all done with free radical reactions. PVC, polyvinyl chloride, that's all free radical reactions. Okay. So let's, now that we've got these steps involved, let's take these steps and start to put these steps together into some chemical reactions. So let's look at our first reaction, chlorination. Chlorination as a reaction is where we can take a hydrocarbon and react it now with chlorine and light. When we do this reaction, we can chlorinate the molecule, but the problem is that it's difficult to control. It makes CH3, Cl, it makes CH2, Cl2, it makes CH, Cl3, and can even make CCl4. And you get all products that come out of this. So methyl chloride, dichloromethane, this is trichloromethane, and carbon tetrachloride. We also, the dichloromethylene is also called methylene chloride. And the trichloromethane is also called, keep wanting to say formal chloride, but it's not. It's not methyl chloride, and it's not, the name will come back to me in a little bit. I'll get it back in a bit. Anyway, it's difficult to control. And part of the reason that it's difficult to control is that when we look at its mechanism,
chloroform.
Thank you. That's what I was trying to get to. A formal group is a CH group, which is why I kept going back to formaldehyde in my brain, and I was trying to come up with the chloroform. But so a methylene group, when we look at a CH2, this is a methylene. A CH3 is a methyl. A CH is a formal. And so that's where those names come from. Chloroform from the single CH formal group, and the methylene chloride. Okay, mechanism. The mechanism starts with the initiation step and the light fragmenting the chlorine. So here we break the bond homolytically and we produce two of the free radicals. I'll just draw one for now. We don't need to draw both. The next step is an abstraction of the proton from the methane. Which generates the carbon radical. So we end up with HCl, and we end up with a carbon free radical that is sp2 hybridized, trigonal planar. So there's my free radical sitting in that empty p orbital. Now, oftentimes I'll draw the orbitals, but sometimes those orbitals get in the way. So sometimes what we do is we just draw the free radical without actually putting the orbital there to make it a little bit easier to see what's happening. Okay, the next step is an abstraction of the chlorine from another Cl2. And in this case, what happens is the bond fragments and electrons flow out of that bond and they make the first chlorinated product. And what's still hanging around is chlorine-free radical. And so this mechanism continues to go. The next step would be the abstraction of a proton again.
That's why you put chlorine in a pool, right?
Chlorine goes in the pool, doesn't necessarily react under free radical conditions. Chlorine in a pool will work by many different modalities. I'm sure that free radical may be one of them. There are many different chemical reactions that go on with the chlorine, but the chlorine really isn't there to necessarily chew up organic molecules. In fact, it's rather unpleasant that it does, because these chlorinated organic molecules are toxic, including to us, to all living things. And so it's not that the chlorine is there to undergo free radical reactions and chew up the organic molecules. The chlorine is there to act as a antimicrobial and antibacterial to destroy organisms that are possibly living in the water that could be harmful organisms. And the mode by which it can do that is just as an oxidizing agent as the chlorine molecule itself. It doesn't have to do that free radically. So usually when you have chlorinated drinking water, we worry about these byproducts in chlorinated drinking water because any organic molecules that happen to be in the drinking water, now hopefully we don't have any organics in our drinking water, but if there is, then that chlorine can react with those organics to produce these chlorinated products. And those are toxic and we don't want to have those. So this again produces HCl and then produces the next free radical that's here. And this free radical, the problem with this one is that this is even more stable, that the chlorine, by virtue of having lone pairs on it, can participate in resonance. And this is a more stable free radical. And then this reacts with another chlorine molecule, and the reaction keeps going in a chain reaction. And so it will propagate and continue to chlorinate in the system until we get to the carbon tetrachloride. Producing HCl as a side product. Okay, so it just keeps going in these propagation steps. So that's our mechanism. And that's why it's difficult to control. It's difficult to control because the more chlorines you get, the more stable the free radical becomes. So more chlorines, substituents, act as free radical stabilizer. Which in turn lowers the activation energy for formation. And so it really doesn't want to stop. Nope, that is not what I wanted to hit. It really doesn't want to stop at the methylene, at the methyl chloride. It really wants to keep going all the way to the carbon tetrachloride because that's the more stable free radical intermediates. In each one of these, the activation energy keeps getting lower and lower for subsequent chlorinations. And so these reactions are difficult to control because of that. All right. When we're looking at these reactions, we have what we call radical initiators. Radical initiators are molecules that easily form free radicals. So one example is chlorine, that when we hit it with heat or light, heat or light can cause it to dissociate into the two chlorine radicals. And the delta H formation for this, just to give us an idea of how easy this is 243 kilojoules per mole. Okay, that number in and of itself doesn't give us a whole lot of information, but at least it gives us a starting point to compare these other molecules that we're going to look at. So other radical initiators are peroxides, organic peroxides. These organic peroxides can undergo free radical initiation. They do so by heat or light. And when they fragment, much the same way that these guys are fragmenting homolytically. These guys do the same thing. So they fragment homolytically and they produce alcohols, but not the alkoxide ion and not the alcohol, but the free radical. And we get two equivalents of the free radical.
Does the initiation always happen between same atoms because their electronegativity is the same?
Not necessarily. We can initiate free radicals between two different molecules. It's just that when the electronegativity is the same, it's more likely to fragment homolytically versus heterolytically, right? When the electronegativity is different, you have a dipole moment already established. And so that established dipole moment means that electrons are going to more likely flow one direction than the other. And so you get more of a heterolytic type of cleavage rather than homolytic. But I don't think that that excludes having different atoms homolytically cleaving. I think it's just more common this way. Delta H for this is 159. And then besides organic peroxides, and we've seen these organic peroxides before when we want to do a free radical reaction. HBr and peroxide is a perfect example, right? That peroxide that we're using in HBr, the reason that we're using it is because it's a free radical initiator and it works in just this way. It produces the RO free radical, which then allows the free radical substitution of the HBr. Besides peroxides, we can also see acyl peroxides. So an acyl peroxide looks like this. An acyl peroxide can be broken by heat or light, and it doesn't take very much heat or light to break this apart. This thing, when it breaks fragments in exactly the same way, one electron going each direction, and what we generate now are two of the carboxyl free radicals. And these are resonance stabilized. These have a delta H, which is 121 kilojoules per mole. So the entire time that we're doing this, we're looking at chlorine, which is 243. We're looking at organic peroxides, 159. We're looking at acyl peroxides, 121. These are becoming more and more stable free radicals. We're going from a chlorine free radical to an oxygen free radical, more electronegative, therefore more stable. And then the acyl group, which has resonance, which even further stabilizes the free radical. And then the last one is a very common initiator that you should be aware of. This initiator is called AIBN. And it has cyano groups attached to a molecule that has a nitrogen with double lone pair in it. This is called azobis isobutyl nitrile. And they give it AIBN. So it's the azo IBN. The bis doesn't come into play in it, but azobis isobutyl nitrile, AIBN. Very common free radical initiator because it works at such low temp. It works, I think, right around 40 degrees Celsius. So usually they don't use light for this. It's usually right around 40, 45 degrees. I think it might even be 35. I might even be shooting high. And when it fragments this way. It fragments at this point and at this point. And electrons go here and here. And the other electron comes out of this and goes back to the carbon. And it generates two products. It generates two equivalents of the cyano free radical, which is a tertiary free radical. So there's the tertiary free radical. And the other thing that it generates is the nitrogen gas. And that's an N2 gas, where that thing is the nitrogen with the triple bond and the lone pairs. And that has a heat of formation. What is it? I don't have it. Drat. I'll have to look it up. We'll find it next time. It's low. It's less than 121. Let's just do it that way. I can't believe I don't have that one written down. But anyway, this one is very common. It's used for all sorts of polymerizations, AIBN. It's a solid material. It's easy to weigh out. It's easy to distribute. You store it in the refrigerator. You can very easily weigh out a stoichiometric amount of what you need or catalytic amount of what you need. And it operates at very low temperature. So it's easy to do polymerizations with because you don't have to heat the snot out of anything in order to get it to go. Plus, it generates nitrogen gas and all of it goes off reliably. So it's just a very common free radical initiator to see used. So you watch for the initials AIBN. When you see AIBN, you know you're doing a free radical reaction. So AIBN equals free radical reaction. And that's just what we watch for. Sometimes when we're looking for different reagents, we're trying to figure out what a step is. When we see AIBN in that step, we know that we're doing a free radical reaction. Okay, so if all these things initiate or generate free radicals, how do we inhibit free radicals? What do we do to block free radicals? So free radical inhibitors. Free radical inhibitors are probably just as important as free radical initiators because there's a lot of times where we don't want a free radical reaction to go forward. For instance, THF, tetrahydrofuran, is a solvent. That when exposed to oxygen undergoes a free radical reaction and generates this guy, which is organic peroxide. And this is a contact explosive. It is a solid material that crystallizes out, and any sort of shock to it causes the entire thing to detonate and explode. And so when they sell THF, what they do is they sell THF with quinoline, hydroquinoline. As free radical inhibitor. They call it a stabilizer. What they're trying to do is they're trying to stabilize it from generating the free radicals. And that hydroxyquinoline looks like this. It's, or hydroquinoline. It is a benzene with two hydroxyl groups. And what it does is it reacts with free radicals. So this guy in reacting with a free radical, when a free radical enters the solution, whatever the free radical is, the free radical will abstract the proton. And once it abstracts that proton, we get the oxygen free radical. You end up with the protonated guy there. And then this undergoes another reaction with a free radical, abstracting the other proton. And then there is resonance that happens. And that resonance leads us to quinone. And so what it does, this is called benzoquinone. That hydroquinoline acts as a free radical scavenger and reacts to destroy free radicals because it interrupts the free radical cycle because it doesn't need a quenching step. As soon as the second proton is pulled, it auto quenches itself and it doesn't generate any more free radicals. So it's a free radical scavenger.
That's used in plastic photostabilization and stuff, right?
I believe so.
There's no catalytic free radical stabilizer?
No, because when you react a free radical, you always generate another one. So there's no way to do it catalytically. You can only do it stoichiometrically. There's no way to take a free radical and destroy the free radical without generating another free radical because it's an odd electron. So there's no way to do it catalytically. Another really common free radical scavenger is a molecule called BHT. BHT employs another method. BHT is a phenol. Again, because of the benzylic position and the oxygen, it reacts very easily with free radicals. And so here what happens is the free radical abstracts the proton. And as soon as the proton is abstracted, it does generate another free radical. But this free radical now, and I'm going to exaggerate my tertiary butyl groups. Because what happens with this guy is this is now unreactive. And the reason that it's unreactive is because these tertiary butyl groups don't allow anything to get close to that free radical to react with it. And so, it's unreactive because of sterics.
Does the oxygen kind of retract with this? Like, does that bond get shorter?
No, it doesn't retract. It's just that the proton is very acidic and it's very easy to pull the proton, and the proton extends out a little bit beyond these. But as soon as it goes to the oxygen free radical, these tertiary butyl groups prevent any large R groups from getting in here and reacting with this. And they just prevent that free radical from reacting. So BHT, if you look at any cereal packaging, the cereal packaging or cracker packaging or bread packaging almost always contains BHT. And BHT is a free radical inhibitor to prevent the materials from going stale, from having oxygen and other free radicals get through that packaging and causing the material to go stale. So this is another example of how to inhibit free radicals with sterics, as opposed to the stability that we saw out of the other molecules. All right, time check, 10:12. I've got 20 minutes and a difficult subject to explain. Let's look at, this is regioselectivity, then we'll do stereoselectivity. Oh, the regio is the hard one though. Regioselectivity. Okay, in regioselectivity, what we're asking the question is, when we go through and do a halogenation, and we do X2 and light, we wind up getting two products. Or sometimes we get more, but there's the two possible products that we can get. And the question is, which one of these is major and which one of these is minor? And as an example, if we take propane, and do a chlorination, Cl2, with light, usually this is just a grow lamp. It is a wavelength that is, it's in the UV frequency. I can't remember what the actual frequency is that we're interested in, but most of the time what we do is we use a grow lamp for plants, and we hook that grow lamp up in front of the chemical reaction, and that supplies the light that is sufficient to cleave the chlorine and to start the free radical reaction. We make 2-chloropropane and we make 1-chloropropane. And the ratio in which we make them is 72% to 28%. Okay, and so we would look at that and we might reason that this could be entirely explained by the difference in the free radicals, in that we might expect that this is a secondary free radical and a primary free radical, and we know that a secondary free radical is more stable than a primary free radical, and therefore it should have lower activation energy in its formation. So we might assume that on an energy diagram, that we're thinking about a chemical reaction that is starting from the same product and is going to two different materials here, intermediates where I may have the secondary and I may have the primary. And so my reaction is kind of going through pathways that looks like this. To continue down. And so we might assume that that's the answer, but what we can do is we can also ask the question, how many protons are available to be replaced? And so when we look at the number of protons that are available to be replaced, the different types of protons that we see are that we have these guys that are out here and these guys that are secondary. And so these are all HAs. And these guys are HBs. So let's use some color here. Here's HB. And these guys are all HA. Right, and so I've got the different types of protons that are available in this. I can calculate the rate. I can calculate the rate for the replacement of primary versus secondary. And the way that I do that is I set up an equality. I say 72% over 28% is equal to, and now I need to be careful here when I set this up, because I look at the rate of the secondary. So 72% is the secondary, right? And there are two secondary protons. So this equals the rate of the secondary times two protons. And for the rate of the primary, it's 28%, but there are six protons. So this is going to be equal to the rate of replacement of the primary times six protons. And now I can solve for these rates so that what I can take and do is I can multiply both sides by six and divide both sides by two. And what I will get is I will get 6 times 72% over 2 times 28% is equal to the rate of the secondary. That should be a subscripted secondary over rate of the primary. And when I calculate that out, that comes out to about 3.9 to 1. And what that means is that a secondary proton is replaced 3.9 times faster than a primary proton, if that makes sense. Secondary proton, 3.9 times faster replaced. Than primary. And in fact, what I find is that for chlorination, when I do enough experiments, we find that the rates are relative rates. Not absolute rates, but relative rates of 3.9, let's see, 1 to 3.9 to 5.2. And so this is for primary, secondary, and tertiary. In that the tertiary is replaced 5.2 times faster than the primary. And a secondary is replaced 3.9 times faster than a primary. And so when I go and I do chlorination, it's more likely that I'm going to chlorinate in a tertiary position than in a secondary or primary position. So an example of that may be that I have a molecule that has both primary, secondary, and tertiary positions. So I have primary position here, secondary, tertiary, and these guys are all primary out at this end too. And if I do chlorination, and I do it with light, that what I will get is a slew of different products. But I could calculate their ratios if I wanted to. I could calculate specifically using these values and how many protons I'm replacing. I could calculate the percentage of each one of these. Now, I'm not going to do that because it's not really important for us to be able to do that. But what I can tell you is that because this is the tertiary center, this is the major product. Even though there's a single proton there, that single proton is replaced at a much faster rate than the primary or secondary. And so it's selective for tertiary positions. You guys with me? Okay, something interesting happens when we look at bromination. And so I want to understand bromination in comparison to chlorination. That guy over there. It just looks cleaner. Okay, so let's look at bromination now and what bromination does. When I look at bromination, I can brominate the same molecule. This we do with Br2. We use light, 60 degrees, And we wind up with two basic products. We wind up with substitution of the tertiary position and of the secondary position. And percentages, it's 90% to, I thought I had 9%. I think it is 9%. And then there's some other products here that are 1% other stuff, right, that comes out in these other positions. But these are the two main ones. And the tertiary is 90% in terms of its replacement. So when I look at the relative rates of bromination, and I would go through and do the same calculation, right? There's one proton that can be replaced here, two protons that can be replaced here, 90 and 9. I can go through and I can calculate out the relative rates. I could do some more experiments with these other percentages and I could calculate out their relative rates. And what we find out are that the relative rates are 1 to 82 to 1640. That is primary to secondary to tertiary. That's the relative rates of bromination. Let me remind you that chlorination was 1 to 3.9 to 5.2. And that this was chlorination. And so there's a big old question mark here as to look at that number and that number. Bromination and chlorination are essentially the same thing. They're both halogens. Why is the bromine so much more selective for the tertiary position than the chlorine? The rates of chlorination are relatively similar, 1 to 3.9 to 5.2. They're all very similar, but the bromination is 1 to 82 to 1640. Bromination is insanely more, more selective for the tertiary position. So, I mean, this has practical implications that most of the time when I do a halogenation, I choose to do a bromination than a chlorination because bromination is so much more selective. So bromination, way more selective. Why is it more selective though?
Not because of sterics.
Not because of sterics. It's actually bond dissociation energies and the strength of the bromine hydrogen bond and the bromine carbon bond versus the chlorine halogen bond, chlorine hydrogen bond, and the chlorine carbon bond. It has to do with those things. So I could give you the numbers, but in a nutshell, I could draw it for you and make more sense. So let's try and do it this way without the numbers. We can always go back to the numbers if we want to. But here's what the energy diagrams look like. So we'll do chlorination first. And then this is a perfect note that I want to end on for today. So chlorination looks like this. We start off over here. We go to a spot up here. We come down this here and we end up over here someplace. So chlorination looks like this. That'll help me out to make these guys. And what we're looking at is we're looking at the steps where where we're looking at the proton abstraction first. So we start off with RH and the chlorine free radical. We go to the transition state, where this is the chlorine pulling the proton. And we have a partial radical and partial radical. And then we go down here to, this is where we have pulled the free radical. So this is the Cl and the H. And then that last step is where it's reacting with a new chlorine. And we go through R, chlorine, dot, 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 chlorine. This is the partial radical and partial radical. And then this is our RCl that's been generated down here. Okay, and the rate determining step is right there. This is my rate determining step. That's for chlorination. Now we take that picture and we look at it for bromination. In bromination, the energy diagram looks like this. And we start off with RH and the bromine radical. We go through the RH bromine, partial radical. This is my activation energy and my rate determining step. And this is my R radical. This is going to react with the bromine. It goes through its transition state. And then I form finally our Br. Okay, so let's ask a question, right? What determines these activation energies? And what is the general principle that I'm interested in to understand what governs the structure of these transition states? Or let me ask this. I'll find another way to phrase it. This transition state, is this transition state more like the starting materials or more like the carbon-free radical? What does the transition state resemble?
What's that called again? The principle, whatever.
That's right. That's what I'm looking for. That's what I'm getting at. It's called Hammond postulate. Okay. This is all about Hammond. Okay. You want to understand this? You need to understand Hammond. What does this transition state resemble? Does it resemble the starting material or the product?
Well, it's more like the starting material.
It's more like the starting material because Hammond links it to the side that it's closer in energy to, right? So Hammond links it like this. So this transition state is starting material-like. Okay, that means that that transition state is all about the chlorine-free radical. Okay. What about this transition state over here? Is this transition state more like the bromine-free radical or the carbon-free radical?
Well, it's more like the carbon-free radical.
It's more like the carbon-free radical. Okay, so now we're getting someplace. Now, when I look at what governs the transition state, the hydrocarbon that's over here, this guy, trying to get the pointer, this guy, RH, whether it be primary, secondary, or tertiary, has very little influence over this transition state. This can go up and down, and it changes this very little because there's the free radical exists on the chlorine, And so whether this is primary, secondary, or tertiary makes almost no difference. So primary approximately equal to secondary, approximately equal to tertiary, very little difference. And so it has no influence on the transition state because the free radical is on the chlorine, not on the carbon. But on the other side, now this is a carbon-free radical. Now we have primary is less stable than secondary. And the secondary is way less stable than tertiary. And so as this thing gets more stable, it brings this down. It lowers the activation energy. It makes huge changes in the activation energy. Actually, I should change this color that if I drop this and I make this more stable, such as a tertiary, then it will lower my activation energy. If I increase this by primary, then it will increase my activation energy. And I get rates that are vastly different. So my rates here now run 1640 to 1, whereas this guy over here has little bitty changes. And so it runs 5.9 to 1. Because what's influencing this is the carbon-free radical. And the carbon-free radical is vastly different, whether it's on primary versus secondary versus tertiary. What's over here? The free radical is on the chlorine. Primary versus secondary versus tertiary has almost no influence on the transition state. And that has to do with the bond dissociation energies and the stability of the bromine hydrogen bond versus the chlorine hydrogen bond. And that the chlorine hydrogen bond is just not all that, or I should say the chlorine hydrogen bond is more stable than the bromine hydrogen bond. If we look at which one is a stronger acid, and I ask you which one of these is the stronger acid, HCl or HBr, which is stronger?
DHCl.
No.
No.
HBr is way stronger. They go in order of FH, HCl, HBr, HI, and the more stable F minus, Cl minus, Br minus, and I minus, that this guy is small and these guys get bigger and bigger. And because of that, these conjugates are more stable. As the I gets more stable because of its large size and polarizability, then this guy becomes the, This guy becomes the stronger acid. And so as HI is a stronger acid, HBr is a stronger acid than HCl. And what that means is that as I go up here, as I generated HBr, HBr is sitting in this zone here, HBr is way less stable than HCl. So it's about these two guys right here. Let me choose green. It's HCl versus HBr. And that HCl is way more stable than HBr. And that's what's playing into these energies and these locations and this whole Hammond postulate. It's just a beautiful example of Hammond postulate and understanding the stability of these guys and why the selectivity is what it is. So this is bromination. If this argument is escaping you, this is all you need to remember. This is the major important thing. Just remember that bromination is more selective than chlorination and that we generally choose to do bromination because it's more selective for the tertiary position. And that's the crux of the whole argument. The argument, I think, is a beautiful argument because it takes it to Hammond postulate. And Hammond postulate is so immensely powerful in understanding why these reactions are they are. You can look at the energy diagram, and just from the energy diagram alone, we can infer that bromination is going to be way more selective. To understand how much more selective it is, to see those numbers, 1640 to 5.2, that's an astounding difference. That's orders of magnitude different in terms of its selectivity. And that selectivity is brought about because of bond dissociation energies. The greater stability of HCl and its influence on the Hammond postulate and the energy for the transition state for the formation of that HCl versus HBr. And that's the beauty in the argument. Okay, it's one of my favorite arguments in organic chemistry. Whether you buy into it or not is the harder thing. I'm a little over time, but I love this argument. And so it's just beautiful in my opinion. Okay, we'll do some examples with halogenation, bromination, chlorination. I'll show you a few more things. We'll talk about stereochemistry. And we have just a little bit more on halogenation. I'll go through some free radical polymerizations. Maybe half of the next lecture will be some free radical stuff. In the meantime, you guys have a quiz to go do. I put a quiz up in Canvas. Go take a look at that quiz. Get that quiz done. You got time to do it over the weekend. I think I may have put Friday as a due date. I can extend that a little bit, give you guys time over the weekend to work on it. Okay?
Thank you.
All right, you got marching orders. I'll see you guys later.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You're welcome.